Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, a review of Pennsylvania's criminal sentencing guidelines. But up front, before the coronavirus pandemic, racial justice reckoning, and presidential election of 2020 all dominated our collective attentions, criminal justice reform was at the forefront of police changes being considered and discussed. From a political standpoint, it was a bipartisan issue. However, the American Civil Liberties Union of Pennsylvania has updated their More Law, Less Justice report to say, ironically, state lawmakers are enacting more criminal laws and penalties that are contributing to mass incarceration and away from reform. To discuss this during this portion of today's program is Elizabeth Randall, Legislative Director with the American Civil Liberties Union of Pennsylvania. Ms. Randall, welcome to the program. An update of the earlier More Law, Less Justice report from the ACLU. In broad terms, what did it find?
Well, first of all, good morning. Thank you for inviting me and for covering this, what we think is a very important issue. But broadly speaking, what we looked at last session, so this updated report covers the legislative session for the years 2019 and 2020. Within that two-year legislative session, we saw over 280 bills that were filed that would have increased mass incarceration. Of those 280 bills that were introduced, 14 acts were enacted, which created 15 new criminal offenses or sub-offenses and 26 new penalties. And those 14 acts were 100% bipartisan.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, what you just listed the numbers, but there's a lot there, but before we go into that, when you say that would contribute to mass incarceration, in what way would it contribute to mass incarceration?
So, you know, I'll just start by saying, you know, one of the reasons why we started writing and developing this report was looking at the sheer amount of our time that we spend within the legislature trying to beat back bills that would do one of three things largely. The first is the creation of any new criminal offenses, the creation of or escalation of penalties or grading, so the punishment, the amount of time that somebody is punished, looking at, and also the problem of the legislature creating duplicative offenses. And so those are the three sort of main areas where, you know, anytime, the way we like to sort of describe it is that that the creation of all of these new criminal offenses has a significant effect on the amount of how long people spend incarcerated, the amount of offenses that someone can be charged with. So when prosecutors can use lots of these different offenses to cobble together charging documents for defendants and in effect ratchet up the potential penalty so much that it leaves pretty much anyone other than someone who might not have good counsel with the only option being that they will agree to a plea deal. And so all of these in effect have the legislature churning out all of these new offenses, duplicative offenses, and sort of in a relentless way, increasing the number of penalties that attach to those offenses has the effect of making more things and behaviors criminal. It has the effect of allowing prosecutors to charge multiple offenses and therefore stack charges and sort of coerce people into plea deals. And then keeps people, if they are convicted or if they plea, then it keeps people in prison for longer.
But, you know, there are a few things that the legislators, as you mentioned, bipartisan, by the way, there's both Democratic and Democrat and Republican, would say is that things change. New laws are needed to deal with a crime that is committed more often, or, you know, there is a segment of the population that is victimized more often. What do you say to that? I mean, when they, you know, the legislator who thinks legitimately that this is the reason that these laws are being enacted is that there is a need for them.
So what I would counter that by pointing out first that, you know, Pennsylvania's crimes code was enacted in 1972, and it was a very clean, comprehensive, succinct way of categorizing all of our criminal behavior into a very careful grading scheme that had where everything sort of fit into place. And most of those, and those that consisted of 282 distinct criminal offenses and sub-offenses. And as a result, it worked as many of them are broadly defined in order to capture and to be able to absorb some of those fluctuations of what one might say are new crimes or you need to criminalize something more. By 2010, that number, the number of offenses grew to 636 offenses. And in the last 20 plus years, we now are up to over 1,500 separate offenses. And so what I would say to that is, look, we understand that there are awful news stories. There are specific new crime trends that legislators want to that they want to address. But that most of the criminal behavior that they are writing these new offenses to cover are can already be covered under current under the current crimes code. There's already penalties for that. And so what happens is that when the way that Pennsylvania law works is that many of these offenses, it's a little bit in the weeds, but they can't, these they can't be merged at sentencing. And so what happens is that if you were convicted, if a prosecutor charges you with multiple offenses for the same crime, you can be sentenced separately for each of those. And each one of those carries a statutory minimum and maximum amount of penalties. And often people serve those sentences consecutively, namely back to back, instead of at the same time. And so, you know, I would say with the exception of things like adding fentanyl, like new drugs, perhaps to some of the definitions, for the most part, you know, almost without fail, most of the behavior that legislators are trying to address is already covered under the current crimes code and under current offenses that already exist, and that there's absolutely no need for them, certainly not at the absolute breakneck pace that they have been passing this kind of legislation and just escalating and ratcheting up the number of offenses we have in our crimes code.
If you're just tuning in, our guest during this portion of the program is Elizabeth Randall. She's legislative director for the American Civil Liberties Union of Pennsylvania, talking about their More Law, Less Justice report that has been updated, talking about Pennsylvania legislators enacting more criminal statutes. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I looked at the list of some of the laws you were pointing to, and I mean, all of them seem to deal with some pretty serious crimes, assaults, sexual assaults. One thing that when we talk about a trend that maybe in 1972 we didn't really think about had to do with trafficking, human trafficking. I mean, when you look at them on the surface, these look like legitimate laws. Okay, legitimate. I don't know whether that's the right way to explain it or not, but laws that are dealing with issues that the criminal justice system and crime victims are dealing with right now. But so it seems to me as though your biggest complaint or criticism is that there already are laws that it's duplicative, that there already are laws that handle those things.
Yes, that's exactly correct. I mean, there are, we are not saying certainly that the issues or the some of the problems that legislators are trying to address or that they're concerned about are not legitimate problems to be concerned about. That is not certainly the argument. The problem is that, you know, on the one hand, if, you know, first of all, I would say that those behaviors are largely covered currently under our statute, under existing offenses. In addition, however, to that, you know, when legislators should have a lot of tools in their toolbox, and it seems like this is the only one that they repeatedly use. And by that, I mean, if you're really concerned about trafficking or other issues, there are a multitude of organizations who have spent the better part of their time as organizations puzzling over some of these very difficult questions and interventions, types of resources to offer people far earlier in the process. So if the idea is to try to address the problem, what seems to happen is that the bulk of the attention, the bulk of the legislation, and certainly the bulk of the money is spent at the end of the process when the harm has already been committed and when it offers the best opportunities for piling on charges. I mean, if you look at some of the trafficking, you know, the ways that definitions have been expanded in terms of trafficking, it starts to sweep in a lot of behavior that your average person, when you think of human trafficking, sex trafficking, labor traffic, any of those very terrible problems, is starting to capture things that most people would not even consider part of that definition. And so what it does, it enables a huge dragnet for police to be able to charge lots of different, it allows police to enforce these offenses, often sometimes selectively. It allows prosecutors to then to stack those charges, and it usually means more time in prison. So we usually think of this issue as being a problem. The effects of the increases in these penalties are the effect of disparate and sometimes selective enforcement by police, the stacking of charges by prosecutors, and more time in prisons.
And we'll talk about those things, but you know, something you just mentioned when you were talking about that was that when you're saying that come into more contact with police, and this seems tied in some way to the events of the past year with so much attention being focused on violence or police brutality. Is it? I mean, I think in the report you even mentioned that you're looking for ways to keep people from coming into contact with police more often.
Absolutely. No, that you hit the nail on the head. There's no question that this is all connected. I mean, every single issue, I think it's important to remind the listeners that these are any offense that is enforced or not by police is everything begins with the legislature. So most of the issues and problems within our criminal legal system, which begin, many people sort of begin that sort of narrative with police officers, but it actually begins with the legislature. None of those offenses can be enforced, whether, you know, equitably or selectively or disproportionately, without those offenses being on the books. And so the more offenses you create, the more opportunities. There's no possible way a police officer would ever be capable of enforcing every single one of the offenses and doing it in a way that is, you know, equitable to some extent. Not that that would be probably a good idea, but there are so many offenses that it's a veritable buffet of offenses to select from. And so you put those sorts of options in the hands of law enforcement, and they will enforce what's available to them on people and communities where they happen to be, or where they are going into. And so, you know, it all sort of begins, we like to try to begin the narrative really with the legislature. And because a lot of heat comes down on police officers, much of that is certainly justifiable, but it is not entirely on them. They are responsible for enforcing the laws that the legislature enacts.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest during this portion of the program is Elizabeth Randall, legislative director with the ACLU of Pennsylvania. We're talking about their More Law, Less Justice report that has been updated, talking about the laws that the Pennsylvania legislature has enacted, that the report says is that many of them are duplicative and will result in more people going to prison. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Elizabeth, I can't help think, and this is just where my mind went when you were talking about some of these laws being duplicative, and that... You know, that often when the LGBTQ community was targeted by violence and there would be a proposal or proposals to try to either create a new law or to, you know, include that community as part of hate crime legislation, for example. And one of the pushbacks would be that, well, we already have assault laws in place, so why do we need this? I mean, what do you say with a comparison like that?
I mean, look, I think this is where the ACLU sometimes, you know, can be on different sides than many of our allies. I mean, we certainly sympathize with and are concerned about escalations of violence that are targeted at any particular community. But typically, the way of resolving that is not just through penalizing and duplicating offenses that can already be charged. And so, you know, we have a, you know, our position on hate crimes is a bit nuanced, where, you know, we have great concern sometimes that in order to prove a hate crime, you have to show intent. And so as a result, we have, we're sort of sticklers for at the absolute minimum, including language that does not allow someone's First Amendment protected speech to be used as evidence against that person to show that they had particular intent or hatred or intent toward another, targeting a specific group. But, you know, on balance, all of these, you know, anytime you create new offenses, it has devastating, you know, consequences for all kinds of communities, including those specific communities themselves. We've seen, you know, some of this targeted legislation sometimes boomerang and come back to hurt the very communities that were originally supportive of it. And so, you know, we would rather see money. You know, we're in budget season right now. I'm expecting that the corrections budget this year, their annual budget will probably get past the $3 billion, that's billion with a B, mark, the annual amount of money that the Commonwealth spends on incarceration. And I would far prefer to see those resources spent more at the front end rather than at the back end.
But at the same time, you know, we went into this talking about criminal justice reform. Actually, Pennsylvania's state prison population, inmate population, has been shrinking. I mean, not by huge numbers or anything, but it's down from where it was 5 or even 10 years ago. So even with these new laws that you're talking about, or duplicate laws, that you know, there are fewer people going to prison.
Well, that's, yes, I will say that certainly the I think there has been a very good effort by the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections to reduce the numbers in the prisons. And you're absolutely right. Those numbers are going down. Unfortunately, the budget is not. And so that continues to tick up every year. But you also need to remember that there are not just state prisons in Pennsylvania. There's also county jails. And so you have in a lot of those is where you have a lot of people who, because of the charges that they have, are languishing pre-trial, meaning before they've been convicted of anything. And so you have, you know, to look at the bigger picture overall, you know, Pennsylvania is still, the numbers may have changed a bit. We're either second or third in the Northeast of the country in terms of our incarceration rate. We have the second highest number of people who are on criminal supervision in the United States. And so we, you know, we certainly are not, you know, in a position to be sort of, although I don't want to take away from the efforts that have been made to reduce Pennsylvania's prison population, at the same time, they could use a lot more reduction because we are so I think, comparatively speaking to our neighboring states, like so out of proportion in terms of the amount. I mean, Pennsylvania incarcerates more people than the average for the United States, and certainly the United States just is the biggest incarcerator of any Western democracy. And so we're not really in a great position to begin with, and so we certainly can use that decrease, but we are by no means in a good spot with the number of people that we incarcerate.
We have a listener who asked a question, a specific question, wanted to know if you could provide a detailed example of a law or laws that you feel duplicate laws already on the books.
So that's a good question. I would say, you know, this was one actually, I believe that was passed last session. So there was a sub offense that was created called misrepresentation of military service, which was one of the, I think, in the people being concerned about someone misrepresenting themselves as a veteran in order to obtain money or other benefits. And so that crime was graded as a third degree misdemeanor, which carries a maximum 1 year penalty of incarceration. But that offense, you know, some of the behavior, all the different things that you might assume would go into misrepresentation of military service, could be charged potentially, and obviously the facts of the case would differ, but could potentially be charged as under theft by unlawful taking, theft by deception, tampering with records or identification, or identity theft. So you have four already existing offenses that someone could, that a prosecutor could use to charge someone who has engaged in that kind of behavior without making now a very specific new offense that is specific to a very particular definition of what misrepresentation would mean. And those focus specifically on military service. And so once you start into that, the sort of itemizing. So this is typically what happens. You get these increasingly narrow definitions or target populations that are written into the crimes code. And so if I'm a prosecutor, I could now charge someone with this new offense, the misrepresentation of military service, plus potentially, and again, this might be, I don't know if all of these would be applicable to one action, but potentially you could charge the new offense plus theft by unlawful taking, plus theft by deception, plus tampering with records or identification, plus identity theft, each of which would carry its own minimum penalties. And so you could say, well, originally that offense was only supposed to be the maximum of 1 year, but there's nothing that precludes a prosecutor from charging those other offenses. And so you could potentially, something that might only be punished by a year in prison at the maximum, could be looking at a far longer prison sentence. And so as a result, you know, people don't tend to go to trial. The sort of law and order image of the universe is just not how our criminal legal system works. But so they would probably take a plea deal, but end up doing either more time and or, you know, be sentenced to supervision for a longer period of time.
A couple things about that. One, that probably is in response, that law is in response to some, I won't say highly publicized, but some cases, yeah, that you hear about more often. But at the same time, it's not like there is this wave of stolen valor cases out there that is contributing to mass incarceration. I mean, many of those of the other laws that you point to are not, are not nonviolent crimes, for example. I mean, many deal with sexual assaults or assault. One in particular that caught my eye is that it created a new statute for an assault on journalists. Reason being is that that has occurred over the, that has occurred more often over, over the past few years. So I guess my point is that, that example is not, it doesn't appear to be contributing to mass incarceration, but like the journal assault on journalists, for example, is in response to something, a new crime that has taken root in the last few years.
Sure. But I mean, I would say this, you know, that that's, there's no question that, but the, you know, my our argument back would be, you know, that these, if once you start to itemize your the crimes code in that kind of way and creating a new offense just for attacks on journalists, that now creates, now anyone who does that could be charged with that offense plus any number of other offenses that have to do with the specific course of conduct, like what the actual incident entailed. And so, for example, I'll just give you a quick, so this itemizing problem had, we've seen this and we mentioned this in the report, we see this most clearly with our aggravated assault statute. And that is sort of a section that began originally as a way to automatically increase the penalties for someone if they assaulted a police officer, first responder, and I believe it was judges, and some other, you know, it's a very sort of short list of public officials, first responders, law enforcement, if you assaulted them while they were on the job. What's happened, and so aggravated assault carries with it a 10-year, it's a felony, it's a second degree felony, and it carries with it a 10-year maximum penalty of incarceration. And so, but the way that that provision is defined is that if you commit a simple assault, which would otherwise is a misdemeanor, would carry 2 years of incarceration, even if what you what you do is a simple assault against a police officer, et cetera, that charge automatically gets ratcheted up to a felony charge. Now, what's happened over the years is that in the interest of sort of protecting, wanting to indicate that you care about certain groups of people who have certain particular kinds of jobs, that list has ballooned up to 39 different types of employees. So now it includes parking enforcement officers, psychiatric aides, public utility employees, DEP employees, et cetera, waterways conservation officers. And so now if you commit a simple assault against someone that would normally carry with it 2 years, and you commit a simple assault against any one of those people while they're on the job, that ends up ratcheting up to a second degree felony, 10 years of incarceration. And so, you know, it's turning into this insane list of, like, I don't even know why simple assault to some extent might even be necessary anymore. I mean, it's everything now, if you touch someone, if they have a specific type of job while they're on the job, you're facing a second degree felony charge. And so, and last session alone, there were 15 bills that sought to add a different, you know, so one of them, of course, you know, we had healthcare workers. Okay, we're talking about the pandemic. You don't want people, you know, assaulting them. But to say that any assaults, a simple assault against them automatically can be charged with a aggravated assault. Some of them in the positions or employment categories that the legislature tried to add last session included youth shelter workers, code enforcement officers, school crossing guards, and the like. And so, so what happens is that every time you sort of carve out specific definitions of these offenses, it means that you are just loading up prosecutors. You're really handing them live ammunition in order to stack, you know, to charge people with multiple offenses. What ends up happening is really what we have is crisis, I would say, in our country, where, you know, we might have the right to the the right to trial, our right under the Sixth Amendment to a trial. We don't really have that anymore, because most, you know, the vast majority, 90% and upwards of all cases are the results of plea deals. And that has in large measure is the result of having so many different options for prosecutors to cherry pick and to cobble together charges and scare people into pleading instead of going to trial.
Well, the argument probably could be made that it benefits some of those people who are charged for not going to trial as well, but we'll leave that for another program. One final question, Elizabeth. How do you want this report to be used?
So I think probably I would say in two ways. First is to impress upon the public how important it is to pay attention to what is happening in the state legislature. I know that a lot of us tend to be sort of sidetracked by what's going on at the federal level, and not that that is not certainly important, but I would say that it is vitally important for people to pay attention to what is happening in Harrisburg. That's where a lot of almost all of the decisions around criminal justice all of those decisions are made. And then secondly, we make sure that the legislators see this. I think it's not always the case that they can, you know, we are trying here to provide a kind of 30,000, 60,000 foot view in terms of what the patterns are of how the types of bills that they consider, how many get filed, how many get considered, and how many get enacted. And that, if people are trying to talk about criminal justice reform, the pace at which the legislature is passing these bills is going so fast that any of the incremental reforms, which are always good, and we encourage, perhaps even a more aggressive kind of reform. I mean, the changes or the reform that is being enacted cannot even come close. I mean, we are far outpacing any of the reform efforts by this, like, relentless onslaught of criminal offense bills.
Elizabeth Randles, legislature.
And so we just ask them to please put their pen down. That's our takeaway for the legislature, is just stop. At the very least, you don't have to do anything else. Just stop passing, stop writing the bills, stop considering them. So,
Elizabeth Randle is legislative director of the ACLU of Pennsylvania. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. The Pennsylvania Commission on Sentencing Review and revised sentencing guidelines in response to legislative actions and court decisions. After many legislative changes over the years, as you just heard, their current guidelines are considerably different than the first set adopted in 1982. The commission met this month to review sentencing guidelines. Joining us on today's program, Mark H. Bergstrom, who is executive director of the Pennsylvania Commission on Sentencing and an associate teaching professor in criminology at Penn State University, and Wesley Oliver, director of the criminal justice program and professor of law at Duquesne University School of Law. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today. Mark Bergstrom, let me start with you. Before we talk about any revisions, I gave a thumbnail sketch of what the Commission on Sentencing does, but what is the mission for the commission?
Good morning, Scott. The mission is to provide guidelines for courts to consider when sentencing common pleas courts, misdemeanors, and felonies. So the commission looks at legislation that's enacted, creates a recommendation based on a lot of details about that specific conviction offense, and makes a recommendation based on that. And what we find over time is that the guidelines have promoted some stability in sentencing, and also that for first-time offenders, the guidelines generally do not go up to the maximum sentence, but really focus on a lower portion of what the General Assembly has authorized as far as a sentence to be imposed.
I was just talking in the last segment about criminal justice reform. And one of the key provisions of those who support reform, and this is a kind of a bipartisan thing too, is to less reliance on sentencing guidelines, giving judges more leeway. Has that happened? I mean, and is that a part of criminal justice reform?
Well, I think it's clear to understand the nature of our guidelines. We have sentencing guidelines in Pennsylvania that are advisory guidelines. So the guidelines are intended to identify the typical sentence for the typical offender, and then that serves as a starting point for the court. But the court has discretion to go outside of the guidelines. So it differs a lot from what are called presumptive guidelines, and it differs a whole lot from mandatory minimum sentences. So judges have the discretion to sentence as they wish, as long as it's a legal sentence, and the commission gives a starting point and sort of the benefit of statewide data to help drive evidence-based or data-driven recommendations.
And I would just add, I agree with everything Mark said, and I think that advisory guidelines are much better than the rigorous former version of the federal sentencing guidelines. But there is something that happens with sentencing guidelines because they create kind of a presumption, and you live in a world where the public seeks more punishment rather than less, usually, then you create a baseline, and it does create a certain floor rather than ceiling in terms of pressure. But Mark is absolutely right. It does create, in individual cases, still the opportunity for judges to exercise that kind of individual discretion to go down.
And I know both of you were listening in on our previous segment with Elizabeth Randall of the ACLU. Professor Oliver, let me ask you, the report that they put out saying that there were, too many laws being duplicated, that, that there's more opportunity for police to come into contact with people, and it gives police and prosecutors more ammunition for plea agreements. What are your thoughts on that?
So I kind of took the report as a shot across the bat. I didn't see anything particularly problematic in the examples that they cite in this new proposed legislation or this new legislation that has come in the last couple of years. I took this as a description of a much larger problem in the criminal justice system. We have duplicate offenses now that overlap in very bizarre ways. I'll give you what I think is a really great example of this. The difference between third-degree murder and involuntary manslaughter. Juries are asked, if the prosecution seeks third-degree murder, to consider whether it's the higher charge or the lesser. Well, third-degree murder is defined as all kinds of murder that are not any other type of murder. So then how do they actually define this? The jury is instructed based on the common law that if a person has wickedness of disposition, hardness of heart, or recklessness of consequence in their killing, then that is third-degree murder. So what's involuntary manslaughter? It's defined as an act that involves recklessness. The word recklessness appears both in the definition of third-degree murder and involuntary manslaughter. So you've got these duplicate offenses that I don't think reasonable juries can distinguish, and what's the difference in consequence? Well, under the guidelines, it's a difference of 5 years versus 3 months. So the problem I see with a lot of our system is that we have different types of crimes that are indistinguishable that then give prosecutors the ability to charge higher, and juries really don't know what to do with this.
So, Mark Burstrom, how does the Commission on Sentencing deal with, for an example that Wes Oliver just provided?
Well, our starting point is the conviction offense. So, as Professor Oliver said, if someone is charged with and convicted of murder three, that has a 40-year statutory max in Pennsylvania. If someone is charged with and convicted of involuntary manslaughter, that's a misdemeanor one with a 5-year statutory max. So our starting point is we look at the conviction offense and have guidelines based on that. But the professor is correct. There are gray zones or overlaps between a number of statutes. So I think Ms. Randall was on target in saying there have been a lot of additional offenses created, but sometimes that's the result of court rulings that said you can't get a conviction, you haven't proven the elements under this statute, and so the General Assembly is trying to refine the statutes so prosecutors do have the tools necessary that they think they're missing. I think one of the things that was raised by Ms. Randall that I think is important, but we have to recognize, is she talked about merger and how difficult it is for some offenses to merge into the others. And that was partly because of a statute that really restricted what merger is, and that was enacted in 2003. But I think just as important is her point about concurrent versus consecutive sentencing. And I think that's really the responsibility of the courts, because the Supreme Court changed the rules back in 1997 about concurrent versus consecutive sentences, when these sentences are served together versus back to back. And I think that did create an increase in the use of longer sentences because you're connecting multiple sentences together. So overcharging itself or multiple convictions in itself might not be a problem, but if you then are stacking them together in terms of building longer sentences, that can be a problem if it's just used indiscriminately. So I think it's an important issue.
Professor Oliver, I see you nodding in agreement with Mark Bergstrom as he was talking about it. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, he's absolutely right about that. There are two big problems with the way we think about sentencing. One is absolutely what he was saying, that very rarely is an offender convicted of exactly one offense. And we have very careful guidelines that say, if you did it with other people, if you have priors, we're going to enhance you by this much or that much. But there's really no way that we've come up with to figure out what you do when you're convicted with two or three offenses, which is more the norm than the exception. So the judge then has a great deal of discretion to decide whether you stack these sentences together or you run them concurrently. The other part of this is prosecutors, that what you choose to charge is incredibly important. And much like Mark was saying, with judges, they've got to use their discretion in a way that makes this very powerful tool of the criminal justice system make sense. In deciding what to charge, prosecutors also have to add common sense to these rules that really can't be crafted to fit every situation. I remember talking to Ed Rendell one time about Pennsylvania's drug delivery charge. If you sell drugs to someone within 1,000 feet of a school, mandatory minimum of 2 years. I said, you are the DA in Philly. There's no place in Philadelphia that's not 1,000 feet from a school, a church, a playground, et cetera. Let's say a college kid sells, $20 worth of pot to his roommate. Would you charge that kid with a sale under this mandatory minimum? He said, absolutely not. It doesn't make sense. I said, what would you charge the kid with? He said, disorderly conduct. And so what prosecutors do is they figure out, what reasonable prosecutors do, it seems to me, is they figure out how to make the punishment fit the crime. And that doesn't always look like what's on the statute books.
So if you're just tuning in, our guest, Mark Bergstrom, who is executive director of the Pennsylvania Commission on Sentencing and associate teaching professor of criminology at Penn State, and Wesley Oliver, director of the criminal justice program, professor of law at Duquesne University School of Law. We have a few minutes left. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You know, Mark, one of the things I try to stay away from, we could get into the weeds with process sometimes, but this is one of those things that I have the sense that the public really doesn't know a whole lot about. So let's talk a little bit about process, how judges use guidelines, and I'm going to use the word matrix. How is a matrix used?
Yeah, and under the Pennsylvania sentencing guidelines, we primarily focus on two factors. First is the conviction offense. And as Professor Oliver said, we look at each individual offense. So there's a sentence imposed on each conviction offense. But the second factor we look at is what's commonly called criminal history or prior record score. And so what Pennsylvania has traditionally done is really give a very modest sentence for someone with no criminal history and then substantially build the prior record, build the sentence recommendation as someone has a more serious criminal history. Over time, what we found and what the research has found is we've probably overdone the criminal history impact. And so one of the things we're looking at with our review of the guidelines is trying to find the correct balance and perhaps paring back the weight of criminal history in recommending a sentence. So those are some of the key considerations.
All right. So as you just mentioned, and I mentioned in our introduction, that you are in the review process right now. Are there other things that you could, other aspects of this you could tell us about that are being considered?
Sure. And we started working on some of this in terms of an amendment that we adopted that went into effect January of this year. But we're looking at a real rebuild of the sentencing guidelines. One aspect of the guidelines that we added during our amendment was probation guidelines. Up until now, the sentencing guidelines only focused on what we call the in-out decision, whether you remained in the community or were confined. And then if confined, what the duration of that, what the length of the sentence we would recommend. The General Assembly gave us authority during the Justice Reinvestment Initiative a couple of years ago to create probation guidelines. And so we started that during this amendment and we'll be building out that during this rebuilding of the guidelines. The other thing is that our guidelines are very broad. So they give a judge a lot of discretion even within our guidelines. And they allow the consideration of multiple options. And what we've come to understand during this review process is we should really be much more focused. Because they're advisory guidelines, we should focus on the type of disposition, whether probation or county jail or state prison, and the duration, whether it's probation or confinement, and have that as a much more focused recommendation for the court to consider. And then the court, exercising discretion, can go outside of that if the court feels it's appropriate. We think this would be a better use of resources. We could better target recommendations, and that might be part of negotiated pleas as well, which they are today. So those are some of the things we're considering.
We only have about 90 seconds left, and Professor Oliver, over the past year, racial reckoning since George Floyd was killed last year. And, you know, I brought this point up with the ACLU that conditions change. Certain crimes get more attention because of something, you know, because of those conditions. Does that happen on a regular basis, and should it happen on a regular basis, that something is in response, a new law or a new sentence, a longer sentence, in response to a crime that is getting a lot of attention?
Sure. And I guess the question is, like, what exactly are we talking about? If we're talking about a new crime, a crime that didn't really occur before, say something that involves new technology and involves a way in which people can defraud people that didn't used to exist, it makes sense to create a new crime. There are crimes, though, that, as the ACLU correctly identifies, are simply duplicative. And a great example of that was during the Clinton administration, carjacking became a crime. Well, carjacking was always robbery or armed robbery, depending on whether you used a weapon. And so we only really worry about that if we are using that to enhance the penalties. The ACLU is absolutely correct to say that quite often this is done as a political matter, whether or not the penalties are increased by adding a catchy title like carjacking, or by adding like postal workers to special victims whose deaths get punished more vigorously. These things often are about political political optics than they are about real crime policy. So if we're talking about adding new crimes because there's a new issue, then yes, but all too often, it really is about political optics.
Yeah, and we, again, there's a whole other show right there. I want to thank our guests for being with us today. Mark H. Bergstrom, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Commission on Sentencing. Wesley Oliver, Director of the Criminal Justice Program, Professor of Law at Duquesne University School of Law. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a good day.